once you open the door and say there are some lives that aren't worth living, then where do you draw the line?
The dignity and value of life and the role parents and governments play in protecting that life, the growing debate.
Our hope is that we can continue to be of service to men and women religious and to manage the collection so that it's fruitful and supplies needed funds to the religious.
Religious communities face a monumental challenge of funding elder care, the organizations that are providing pathways for religious to successfully retire.
So, like, you know, you read in the Gospels, once you get the call, once you are transformed, you want to share that.
And the call to share the eternal word, the work a former atheist is doing to preach the gospel. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Whose best interest should you side with this? Because obviously the parents' view of the best interests for their child is obviously very different to that of the medical professionals.
The rights parents have to provide life-saving care for their children, an issue brimming with ethical and moral implications that has reached high courts in cases around the world. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. We begin our show with a look at the controversial and emotional topics of euthanasia, assisted suicide, and parental rights over the care of their children. The ethics surrounding the death of an infant British boy drew international attention, even from Pope Francis. The sixth anniversary of the death of Charlie Gard passed just 2 weeks ago. But questions and fallout continues. Should parents have a final say over the treatment of their children, or does that belong with doctors and the courts? Charlie suffered from a rare genetic disorder that causes progressive brain damage and muscle failure called mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome, or MDDS. He could not hear, see, or even cry. It has no cure. Charlie's parents were seeking experimental treatment in New York that had never been tried on someone with his condition. The UK hospital asked a court to override the parents' decision to take him out of the country, claiming Charlie was suffering, which his parents denied. British courts supported the hospital's decision, and the case quickly rose to Britain's Supreme Court and the European Court of Human Rights, which also backed the hospital's views. Charlie's mother blamed the hospital for delaying treatment until it was too late. Charlie was taken off of life support on July 28, 2017, just 1 week before his first birthday. Pope Francis tweeted out shortly after his death, "I entrust little Charlie to the Father and pray for his parents and all those who loved him." While euthanasia and assisted suicide are illegal in the United Kingdom, the UK domestic courts have rejected claims that withdrawing life-sustaining treatment in cases where such treatment is deemed futile constitutes euthanasia. And when it comes to children's health care, questions remain about how much authority parents have to make potentially life-saving decisions. Those fighting for greater parental rights say it's time for change. The short life of Charlie Gard has inspired many, but will it change the hearts of lawmakers? Mark Irons reports.
It was a medical case that grabbed the world's attention. The parents of a critically ill child requesting an experimental treatment to save their son's life. The hospital rejecting that request, claiming it had the best interest of the child in mind. It turned into a prolonged legal fight. In the end, the child, Charlie Gard, would pass away.
I think the case really sets a dangerous precedent.
Dr. Melissa Muscella teaches philosophy at the Catholic University of America. She specializes in end-of-life ethics and parental rights. Muscella reflects back on the Charlie Gard case in the UK. She says one problem it highlighted, placing too much authority in the hands of medical professionals.
Allowing doctors and ultimately state officials to override the medical decisions of loving, competent parents on behalf of their children.
6 years after the death of Charlie Gard, that problem in the UK remains.
There's no guarantee that your voice is going to be 100% acknowledged or your voice has equal weight to that of the clinicians.
Dominic Isam consults for a British political communications agency working on behalf of the Charlie Gard Foundation. He says parents who want medical options for their children can face the threat of fighting healthcare providers in court.
You got parents who simply want the option to pursue an alternative treatment that you know, can improve their child and doesn't, won't cause suffering, and they're not able to do that at the moment.
So an effort is underway to pass Charlie's Law.
It is my view, and the consensus view of medical ethics, that if a treatment is not harmful and reputable doctors are willing to provide it, that no one should be prevented from seeking this treatment.
The law would grant access to mediation services so parents and doctors could resolve disputes, and if doctors believe a medical treatment could be harmful, they would need to provide greater proof.
So I'd have to explain why the proposed treatment that the parents want to pursue at a different place would cause significant harm to that child.
For parents, the right to try different treatments for their child could be the difference between life and death. Charlie's Law has yet to pass, but supporters in Parliament say it's time to give more power back to parents.
For access to mediation and for the right to try.
Having worked with the parents of Charlie Gard, I'm in awe of their humility and willingness to sit around the table with those who opposed them at a critical time for their son, who sadly died.
Connie and Chris, the parents of Charlie Gard, now hope they can improve the future for families who find themselves in situations like theirs.
Charlie, in his short life on this earth, made such an impact on the world. Before we die, if we can make a difference to any family's life through Charlie's Foundation, then that's his legacy, and what a legacy it will be.
And the Charlie Gard Foundation isn't giving up on Charlie's Law. Later this year, the government will review an important third-party report, which could pave the way for change.
That's obviously our hope, that this report that we secured from our work in Parliament will translate into Charlie's Law further down the line.
Dr. Muscala says the Charlie Gard case should be a reminder that every life is worth saving.
Every single human life, no matter how disabled, no matter how young, no matter how sick, is nonetheless precious, infinitely valuable human being made in the image and likeness of God.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
A renewed call for the passage of Charlie's Law was made last year in the UK after a 12-year-old boy was taken off life support against the wishes of his parents. The Catholic Bioethics Centre in England said the case demonstrated a serious lack of respect for the rights of parents and severely disabled patients. And just this past weekend, Pope Francis told World Youth Day pilgrims in Lisbon to always respect life when they discuss the topic of euthanasia. Portugal is one of the most recent European countries to legalize euthanasia. In May of this year, Pope Francis expressed sorrow over the move, saying, "Today I'm very sad because in the country where Our Lady appeared, a law to kill has been enacted." On the Mediterranean island of Cyprus, euthanasia has come front and center of political and social discussions after a British man found guilty of killing his ill wife was released from prison at the end of July. He served 19 months behind bars. Courts found David Hunter not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter, which allows for a suspended sentence. Hunter claims his wife, who suffered from a cancerous blood disease, begged him to end her life because she was in pain. He said he suffocated her before trying to take his own life with pills, but medics saved his life. He's now calling on changes to euthanasia laws in Cyprus, which is sparking ethical debates. Broadly looking at Europe, active euthanasia when a person takes action like giving a lethal drug to another who voluntarily requests it is legal in Portugal, Spain and the Netherlands, Luxembourg and Belgium. Those are highlighted in blue. There are a host of other countries with varying levels of legality of either passive euthanasia when life-sustaining treatment is removed or withheld and assisted suicide when a person takes their own life, typically with the help of a prescription. The issue will be on the ballots in many countries in upcoming elections. And in the U.S., euthanasia is illegal. But the landscape over assisted suicide is changing, officially legal in the states in dark blue, including California, Colorado, and New Jersey. And in Montana, highlighted in pink, it's allowed in theory due to a court ruling, but there is nothing official on the books. Wyoming in gray has no specific prohibition on it, and several states highlighted in orange, like Florida and New York, are considering legislation to protect it. A lawsuit filed in California claims that the assisted suicide law there puts persons with disabilities and minorities at greater risk because many times they lack the same access to health care as other groups. Four disability groups claim the law violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, removes crucial safeguards, and is based on implicit biases about those living with disabilities. The plaintiffs say they won't give up their fight and they will appeal if they lose in court. Dr. Joseph Meany, the president of the National Catholic Bioethics Center, joins us now to dive further into the issues of parental rights. Dr. Meany, these are emotional and very complicated topics. To start, can you break down the difference between assisted suicide, euthanasia, and palliative care?
Assisted suicide is when an individual takes their own life and they're aided in doing that. Euthanasia is actually when a healthcare provider will give a lethal injection or some other means of actually killing that person directly. And palliative care is care that is not directed towards healing a person because it's impossible to heal them, but rather to treating their symptoms such as pain and also helping them with their psychological and spiritual needs.
So then how does that those life-giving measures and how much of that we give work with palliative care? What are those lines and how do we draw them?
Yeah, so the church really talks about ordinary versus extraordinary care. And as a person is approaching death, and some things are not very easy to actually cure, you know, the person has no possibility of actually curing, they're dying, then it makes a lot of sense to do palliative care, right, to take care of their symptoms, but to not give them aggressive treatments that don't really have a positive effect, that would be very burdensome without really curing that person.
So in this story of Charlie Gard, we were talking about parental rights. Is there any instance where the courts or the government know better than the parents?
It would be hard to find some instances. I mean, certainly there are parents that are negligent to their children, perhaps parents who don't really want or acting in the best interest of their children. But I mean, the presumption is that parents want what is best for their children. And, you know, when there is any kind of question about that, usually one has to default and think that the parents are making the right decisions. So it really, barring an aspect of, you know, neglect or abuse, parents, generally speaking, are going to be making the right decisions.
So then why did the Holy Father get involved in the case of Charlie Gard? They were trying to take him off of life support. How do we think about that issue, the idea that life support is what was sustaining his life as he was trying to get that access to experimental treatment?
Yeah, I think the main issue there, of course, was that the hospital was refusing to discharge the patient. And so that was really violating the parents' rights. They said, look, we want to try something else. You have decided that your institution can't do anything more. But other places, and the Holy Father actually identified a hospital in Rome that was willing to take the child, Bambino Gesù. But other places were interested in doing that, and the hospital was not allowing it. So that was really, I think, overstepping the bounds and going past the parents' rights.
And when we think about this as Catholics, as assisted suicide laws make their way around the country, what framework should we use in thinking about these issues of life? What should we be advocating for? What limits should we be trying to put in place?
Absolutely. Basically, the respect that we have for the dignity of every human person means that we will not be killing them. And that is a real ethical line in the sand, that healthcare is about healing. And if you can't heal the person, at least you can give them palliative care or help them. But to actually end their lives or to help them to end their lives is not healthcare. Rather, it is an immoral intervention. So unfortunately, in our modern society, a lot of people think that, you know, suffering has no meaning, that people should be free to kill themselves if they wanted to. But suicide and assisted suicide are really terrible things. And we need to do a lot more education, I think, to realize that this goes contrary to the dignity of the human person. And once it's accepted, it's open to all kinds of abuses.
Well, we're grateful for your information, your witness, and the work of the Bioethics Center. Thank you so much, Dr. Meany.
Thank you.
Up next on EWTN News In Depth, fast-moving wildfires race through a popular tourist spot, forcing the exodus of thousands. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
These sisters, and I would say it about our priests as well, have been very generous with their lives. They've given it all to God.
Still to come, helping those who've given their lives to God and are now in their golden years, the organization supporting retired religious. And abortion continues to prove to be a major force for voters at the polls, even in red states. Analysis up next.
a desperate search for survivors in Hawaii as deadly wildfires tear through the island of Maui tops our Week in Review. The Pope expressed his prayers for those on Hawaii in a telegram to the Apostolic Nuncio to the U.S. on Friday. More than 50 people have died after fires fueled by strong winds of a distant hurricane swept across the island. Flames have engulfed entire blocks of houses and businesses. The area of Lahaina is left in rubble and ash, the scope of the damage called apocalyptic by many. The smoke has covered much of the island. Hospitals are overwhelmed with patients suffering from burns and smoke inhalation. Evacuations are underway for thousands, with airlines increasing flights to neighboring Hawaiian islands. Many have lost everything.
We're all homeless. Thousands of people are homeless in Lahaina, and hundreds, if not at least 1,000, are still missing and unaccounted for.
The U.S. Coast Guard said it rescued 14 people who jumped in the ocean to escape the flames. While evacuees are being housed in temporary shelters, firefighters are still trying to get a handle on the fires. Ecuador has declared a state of emergency following the assassination of a presidential candidate. 50-year-old Fernando Villavicencio was shot and killed at a campaign rally Wednesday night. He was running on an anti-corruption platform. The suspected gunman died in police custody following an exchange of gunfire. Six foreign nationals have been arrested in connection with the killing. Catholic bishops and Ecuador's president have condemned the killing that officials say is linked to organized criminal groups. This as the International Eucharistic Congress is set to be held in Quito next year. A bishop in Nigeria is calling for prayers for the release of a priest and a seminarian who were kidnapped by armed men on August 3rd. The priest and seminarian were abducted in the early morning at the priest's residence. Police are warning Catholic leaders in the area to exercise caution, as kidnappings of Catholic clergy are common. And abortion drove voter turnout in Ohio on Tuesday. Voters flooded the polls with 3 million casting ballots on issue one. Issue 1 would have raised the voting threshold to approve future changes to the state constitution to 60%. Voters rejected Issue 1, and it will remain at 50% plus one vote. This outcome could now pave the way for approval of the proposed constitutional amendment that would add abortion access to the state constitution in the upcoming November election. Joining us to discuss the outcome of this vote and what comes next is Aaron Baer, president of the Center for Christian Virtue in Ohio. Aaron, thank you for being with us. This was not an unexpected outcome. Tell us, what were the circumstances in Ohio, and why was there such an overwhelming support against Issue 1?
You know, what we saw here were a lot of different factors at play, especially at the end. First and foremost, we got flooded with out-of-state money. And by all means, we had money coming in on our side from out-of-state, but the final tally of this is going to be millions, millions more on the no side that came in from California and really from even George Soros-funded organizations. The other thing was, you have to give credit where credit is due. The opposition did a phenomenal job of muddying the waters, and they really targeted core Republican conservative voters. They had a message about how this was going to steal people's rights, steal their vote. You know, one of their ads actually ended with the slogan, "Stop the Steal." And they framed this up well of taking away the one person, one vote, taking away your ability to as a voter to have power. And that was really what sank this initiative, was how powerful their message was. And they got up on TV probably about 2 weeks before our side did and really defined the issue for voters.
Yeah, well, in a state that does have pro-life protections, then how pro-life is the citizenry in Ohio? Is this a reflection of that?
You know, the national narrative right now that people are trying to put out there that this is a show that Ohio is not a pro-life state is really just silly. Again, look back in 2019, Governor Mike DeWine ran to win governor on signing the heartbeat bill. As soon as he got elected, the first thing he did was he signed the heartbeat bill. And then he was up for re-election last year and went against a very pro-abortion candidate who really drove that message in Nan Whaley. And Mike DeWine won 85 out of 88 counties after signing the heartbeat bill, right? And that was after the Dobbs decision, right? The decision that everyone said was going to be so bad for pro-life candidates. So the idea that that Ohio is not a pro-life state, the idea that voters are really ardently pro-abortion in Ohio is just silly. And ultimately, that wasn't the life issue, if anything, really helped drive out our base. We exceeded our hope of voters we were going to drive out to vote yes on this. But it certainly wasn't the reason why this lost.
Right. Well, then what will happen when abortion is on the ballot in November. What comes next for your team and that broader pro-life movement in Ohio?
Well, there is a silver lining in every one of these situations. And this really did give us one a strong foundation to build from with 1.3 million yes votes that we feel like very much understood, considering the amount of propaganda, considering the amount of attack ads, that still 1.3 million Ohioans came out and voted yes is a strong base for us to start from. The other thing is we also see where we need to improve. So this is one of these things national commentators just sort of miss out on the local context. So you take Northeast Ohio, where we did really badly, where issue one did really badly. That's strong union country. That's also strong Trump country up there. That was the areas that Donald Trump really flipped in 2016 in a historic fashion. And those voters, when we really start exposing how radical, how extreme this abortion amendment is, that would allow, you might be pro-choice or you might not be life until conception, but most voters are going to say it's pretty crazy that this would allow a minor to get an abortion without their parents knowing. And that's the opportunity that we have before us in November.
And then how does this loss fit into the broader context of other losses earlier this year? You talked about it not being an apples to apples comparison, but is there something that the pro-life movement is missing?
I think big picture, the pro-life movement is where we were before August 8th. We still have to figure out how to defeat this really aggressive and really broad abortion language. August 8th, the issue one amendment about 60%, this is an idea that has been floating around Ohio really for decades. I actually remember testifying on this idea about 5 years ago. So this was something that was very local, very contextual to Ohio. And again, there are certain lessons in terms of how we need to what we need to do in order to win in November. But the idea that this is emblematic of a broader pro-life issue, honestly, Monte, I just got to say, we were so impressed and so excited about the pro-life response we saw. We saw Catholic churches and evangelical churches stepping up like never before and being ready to go. So in many ways, this is giving us a running start going into November.
God willing, just a practice run. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thanks, Monte.
And a new ballot initiative in Arizona. Pro-abortion activists are working to add abortion in that state constitution. The Arizona Abortion Access Act was filed on Tuesday by a group that claims that the state's current 15-week ban deprives women of autonomy and creates a barrier for health care. The proposed amendment would forbid any regulations from being imposed prior to fetal viability or the ability of an unborn child to survive outside of the womb, a difference of 5 to 7 weeks from the current adopted medical viability standard of 20 to 22 weeks. The Political Action Committee Arizona for Abortion Access hopes to get the measure on the state ballot ahead of the 2024 elections. After the break, concerns about the lack of support for children with disabilities in Catholic schools, the work the church still needs to do to expand access to a Catholic education. A California court dismissed the lawsuit on Wednesday where Jewish parents of disabled students were trying to fight for the right of religious schools to get special education funding. The lawsuit filed by the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty involves a group of Orthodox Jewish parents and two Orthodox Jewish schools against the state of California and the Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest school district in the nation. California state law blocks federal and state special education funding from being used at private religious schools. A federal law called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, is supposed to ensure that all children with disabilities can get an education that meets their needs. IDEA is supposed to help pay for staff training, technology, special ed programs, and other services, including at private schools when public schools cannot meet their needs. Beckett says that what California is doing is unconstitutional, and their attorney, Eric Rosbach, says they will be appealing to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The lawsuit in California comes as the Archdiocese of New Orleans faces a class action lawsuit alleging it discriminates against children with disabilities by incorporating questions about disabilities and medical information on school applications. We brought you that story last week. The attorney representing the two clients in the case argues that schools receiving state money cannot use an admissions application that elicits medical information. The suit is not seeking damages. It only asks the Archdiocese to change the questions on its applications. Catholic schools do not have the best record for opening their doors to children with disabilities. According to the National Catholic Board of Full Inclusion, only 2% of Catholic schools are welcoming to students with intellectual disabilities. Catholic mother Melissa Shanks, who is personally invested in this topic, and Lincoln Snyder, the president of the National Catholic Education Association, join me to provide more insight on this issue. Melissa, let's go to you first. Tell us why Catholic education should be inclusive of all children.
Well, so as you said, I'm the mother of five, and my oldest is 15, and she has a multiple range of disabilities. She's nonverbal and has cerebral palsy and mental disability also. And being our oldest, you know, the other children are going to always remember her formation and how she was included. So a big thing is four of our children do go to Catholic school and our oldest unfortunately doesn't. And, you know, it just sends a message, especially to our family, about how she's included and seen within the community.
An important witness. Well, Lincoln, is this a priority for the NCEA? What would need to happen for there to be more support in Catholic schools?
Well, it is a priority for the NCEA and for all of our Catholic schools. You know, we see our Catholic schools across the country making investments in greater academic inclusivity for students with a different range of learning differences and needs, programs and support introduced. You know, we know that there really are two main ways in which our communities do need to support students with learning differences. There is the question of change of heart and the way that we approach students and taking an inclusive community approach, and we see this at our schools across the country. We also know there's the question of support and funding, and we continue to advocate for philanthropy as well as other avenues of support for students in that area as well.
Now, Melissa, your experience hasn't been great with this exclusion of your eldest daughter. What would you want Catholic schools to do for her? And if they did provide her, would Catholic schools then be your first choice?
Yes. I guess one thing is we've never had people really ask us what it would take to get Nora into the schools. And one thing is because she does have some specialized needs, I think being willing to partner with community programs and find ways to use public funding and other community grants. And then it not always be on the parent to try to figure out and coordinate those things, because we've had many medical emergencies and surgeries along with the special needs journey that just makes the bar to try to advocate only as ourselves a very high one to try to do on our own. So just having more of a partnership and the diocese or schools asking us questions on how they might be able to include Nora.
Lincoln, from the human perspective of flourishing and human dignity, aren't Catholic schools the best place for these kids?
We believe strongly that they are, that our Catholic schools are, at their essence, community schools. They reflect both the community of children as well as the support that an entire community of adults can offer those kids in the context of our Catholic faith. So, you know, the Catholic Church has long acknowledged that schools are a good for the entire parish and the entire diocesan community, and not just something that should be driven by tuition dollars alone. We depend on community support to make our schools work.
And Lincoln, do you think that it's an issue of access to experience with some of these children or even with disabilities in general? Is there a lack of literacy in Catholic schools that you're seeing?
I think that there's always a need for ever greater professional development for all teachers, both in public schools as well as in Catholic schools. We see a growing need. One in 60 students born today will be diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder or related conditions, for example. And so we've seen a real growth in understanding of need as well as in the objective need itself. And, you know, we understand that as educators, we're called to improve our skills to be able to better serve children.
And Melissa, we know that this experience with your daughter is obviously a gift to your family. How do you try to share that gift with the school, even though she doesn't go there?
Well, we've tried to bring her to sporting events and as often as I can, the daily mass with the students. And that has made a big difference in the visibility. But of course, then that puts a lot on me to get her out into the community, which, again, is another hurdle.
Is that something that you would want support on, or is that something that you think that other family members could help you with?
Yes, I think it's a both and. Every family is different, and we don't have a lot of family support in our area. And we've moved, actually, she's been in several different dioceses. So I think it's always kind of monitoring what is the engagement with that student or parishioner, and how much support do they have in their natural environment, and how much support could the school or the parish maybe come in and offer on top of that.
Now, Lincoln, you talked about resources. There's this lawsuit over IDEA funding in California. Do you see roadblocks for schools, Catholic schools specifically, with a faith perspective, to be able to access some of these federal funds that are supposed to serve all students?
You know, it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, state to state, LEA to LEA. You know, we're not facing just one environment as Catholic schools nationally about how to best access resources. You know, we do believe that in some cases, our schools and the students, rather, within the schools are entitled to more resources than they have received. So, we do continue to push hard as a church to see that our students are supported by interests, both private and public, to afford them the best education possible in the school of the parents' choice.
And that they don't have in any way roadblocks for their faith or for their disabilities. Melissa, thank you for your witness. And Lincoln, thank you so much for your leadership.
Thank you.
It's really important that they plan for the future because this is an obligation to care for their members, of course, which they take on wholeheartedly. And, of course, then they want to be able to continue their mission and their ministries. So all this planning needs to go hand in hand.
Planning for a happy and successful retirement. The challenges those who have taken holy vows face when they reach their golden years.
The model in growing old gracefully.
Growing old gracefully and with the proper care. It's a luxury that many religious don't have when they retire. Elderly wage earners outnumber elderly religious in the U.S. by nearly 3-1, according to the National Retired Religious Office. A decline in new religious members and rising healthcare costs have led to hundreds of religious communities lacking the financial resources to meet the retirement and healthcare needs of their aging members. Reporter Rizal Regis takes a look at these statistics and visits a retirement community to see what services they offer in this Catholic Life report.
It's a lovely place to be. It's very peaceful. It's out in the country.
In the small town of Emmitsburg, Maryland, a retirement community of about 50 sisters live in peace and harmony.
Oh God, whose only begotten Son.
These are sisters from the Daughters of Charity. Following the footsteps of St. Vincent de Paul, the daughters devote their lives to serve the poorest in society. Now retired from their everyday responsibilities, these sisters worked in schools, hospitals, nursing homes, orphanages, and out in the streets to help the needy.
I told him I would like to be all my life with children, but I did not want to teach school. And he did a good job. He put me in children's homes all my community life. So when I get up there, I got to give him a special hug for that.
Sister Josephine Murphy is 94 years young and has been living at Villa St. Michael for more than 5 years. From reading books on her Kindle to answering phone calls from children she had taken care of during her vocation, she says she is living her life to the fullest.
And it's beautiful, it's relaxing, and it's a happy life. So I'm truly grateful.
Even Sister Eileen Davis, whose present duty is a sacristan, appreciates all the love and support she receives at Villa St. Michael.
Here we're really like a family, and we're all together and can manufacture some things. Or even sometimes there's so many things going on, you have to pick and choose which ones you will use. I wish everybody could have what we have. You know, it would be a wonderful thing.
Unfortunately, not all retired religious enjoy the same amenities. Today, more and more aging clergy and women religious are in need of such care, as fewer vocations translate to an increasingly aging population. Sister Stephanie Still is the executive director of the National Religious Retirement Office.
She explains that Catholic sisters, brothers, and religious order priests usually serve for little to no pay during their vocation, leading to the lack of adequate retirement savings.
Many institutes do not have money set aside for retirement, so that there's the need still there. There is rising costs for everybody in the United States in terms of health care and caring for elders, and so religious institutes are experiencing that as well.
The National Religious Retirement Office coordinates the annual national appeal for the Retirement Fund for Religious and then distributes financial assistance to eligible religious institutes. In 2021, the office distributed $30 million in direct care assistance to 271 religious orders across the United States. Based on data submitted to the office by participating communities, in 2022, there were about 25,000 retired religious men and women. The total cost for their care every year exceeds $1 billion, which amounts to about $50,000 per member. A Mercer Human Resources Consulting report projected that by 2034, religious institutes will face a retirement funding deficit of nearly $10 billion.
It's really important for institutes to look realistically at their membership now, the levels of care, what's going to be happening in 5 years, 10 years. My hope is that retired religious have a safe and comfortable retirement as they continue to witness to their vows and the gospel and the charism of their own institute.
This goal is shared by Sister Janet Keim, sister servant for Villa St. Michael.
The first thing that we have to be at is morning prayer, and then we have Mass every day at 11. The liturgy, the Eucharist, is really the center of our life, and so we have daily Eucharist in our chapel.
In the afternoon, sisters engage in recreation. Life Enrichment Director Annie Wants and her team plan activities throughout the year, from the big holiday events to outings to smaller events like paint class.
It gives people something to look forward to. I'm going to get up and get moving because there's bingo today, there's pottery today, there's an outing today, there's art class. You know, there's something that means something to me.
We're a family, and so we would take care of our sisters, and luckily we're able to do that in a very nice way.
Father Harry Arnone, who serves as chaplain for Villa St. Michael, describes the sisters as fonts of wisdom and that we should be thankful for their service.
There's an awful lot to be grateful for in what the sisters have done. And I always say to the sisters, because I do believe it, God's not finished with them. As I indicated earlier, they're still ministering to me and to the people who they continue to encounter.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Support and health care for our retired religious is vital, and it comes in many different forms. Sister Constance Feed of the Little Sisters of the Poor has worked in this field all of her career as a nun. She joins us now to explain what that care looks like in their home. Sister Constance, it's great to have you here. The mission of the Little Sisters is known to many of us, caring for the elderly, poor, and dying. How often are those women and men religious?
Well, first of all, thanks, Monsi. It's great to be with you. We have always welcomed a certain number of elderly priests into our home all over the world, and these tend to be diocesan priests, but once in a while, they might be religious priests or religious brothers. It's a little bit more unusual to have women religious because more women religious communities can take care of their own at home, but every once in a while, that does happen. In our home in Washington, we have a half a dozen men between priests and religious brothers who are part of our community.
And what does that look like? Do they come and celebrate the sacraments? Are they cared for 24/7 without them being able to partake in the rest of community life?
Well, they become part of our family while still being a part of their religious community wherever that's possible. The men that we currently have are all up and about during the day, so they're all at Mass. They can celebrate Mass with our chaplain. A couple of them are able to celebrate Mass on their own if we need an extra Mass. But these men participate in activities with the other residents as much as they wish to. They share their meals with the other residents, and then they have a lot of follow their own interests, prayer life, reading, various things, visitors. So it's really up to them how they fill their days. If they would be more infirmed, then, you know, we would take a more active part in making sure that they had meaningful pursuits during the day.
And you're the youngest of your community here in D.C. Is the aging community within the Little Sisters themselves a challenge that you're facing?
Yes, definitely. Our communities around the world are aging. And, you know, I never thought that at my age, which I won't disclose, that I would be the youngest member of community. But that's how it is. So, sure, it has an effect on daily life in our communities. Yeah.
Well, you're a young lady. So quickly, how has the Holy Father's call to engage the elderly given you hope?
Well, it gives me hope that someone, I guess I could say as high placed as the Pope himself, has this so much at heart, and he really does. He talks about this concern all the time. And I just wish that there was a way that it would trickle down a bit more or a bit more quickly. Perhaps you cover it a lot on your program, which I really appreciate. But for all of us in the church family to realize the needs of the elderly and also the very valuable gifts that they still have to offer so that they would be more incorporated into the life of the church.
Well, we're grateful for your vocation and for the gift that you are to the elderly, poor and dying. Thank you so much, Sister
Constance. Thank you, Monsi.
You can learn more about the Retirement Fund for Religious and the work of the Little Sisters of the Poor at the two websites listed on your screen.
Being here is the fulfillment of 30 years.
The trip of a lifetime for one of EWTN's devoted viewers. His story up next. And the journey from non-believer to a faithful Catholic who helps others find joy in the church. Stay with us.
Learning to live our faith with joy. Esther Munt Brooks, a Catholic educator and founder of Fe, Valor y Alegría, Faith, Courage, and Joy, is dedicated to helping Catholics deepen their faith lives. I sat down with her to discuss her own journey into the Catholic faith in this week's Faith Journey in Depth.
Esther, it's so great to be here with you. Thank you for sitting down with us first. You're not usually giving a lot of interviews.
No, but thank you so much. Thank you so much for talking to me about my program, I'm very excited about.
Well, we're excited about it too, because it really gets into the heart of what EWTN is meant to do, which is to help Catholics live an integrated life, where your faith and your life come together and are infused. So tell me a little bit about this apostolate that you kicked off.
Yeah. So this started like around 8 years ago in Washington, D.C., and I noticed that, like what you said, people would go to Mass and then would go home, and then the rest of the week they forgot everything about the Mass and the readings, etc. And then I thought, well, there's more to living our faith than just going to Mass or teaching Mass to our kids or whatever. It's living it in every day, like at work, at home, on the street, driving. That's a good one.
That's very important.
So then I started doing these talks. And when I started, it was specifically for women, Spanish-speaking women in the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. And so I started those talks, and it was like we usually teach a theological point, a small thing, and I teach it, and then I show them how they can apply it in their ordinary lives. What does that mean to have joy? How can I have that joy in my life every single moment of the day, no matter how bad things are going, no matter how much I'm suffering? So for example, joy or hope or whatever, you know, all these different concepts that are very important in our faith, but once we leave church, we forget about them, and we don't know what to do with them, really. So that's why I started this program. I started with women in Spanish.
Yes.
But then I noticed that some husbands would come to the talks, and they would sit in the very back and, like, you know, shyly. And then I said, well, you can come. So they would start coming, and then I would just open it for everybody. Because I noticed that
the need was
faith
there.
Faith is faith, and there's a need for everybody. So, yeah, that's how it happened.
A lot of people are shy as lay people to teach and to engage in the faith in a public way. Before I ask you that question, you're a convert.
Yes.
And that conversion story, did that influence how you started your apostolate?
Absolutely.
And why?
Yeah. So, like, you know, you read in the Gospels, once you get the call, once you are transformed, you want to share that. Mm. And that's what happened to me. I grew up in a very secular home in Barcelona, in Spain. We didn't practice our faith. We didn't go to Mass. I was baptized and I did my first communion, but it was just a tradition, mostly than anything else. And so once I had that big conversion in my heart, it was, I had kids already, and I thought, that I have to share. And I had this zeal, that enthusiasm, that it came from God, because it was not something I made up. And so that's when I started to share that faith. And then I thought, you know, people like me that are so like cynical about the church, and that was me.
Yeah.
I think I can teach or I can understand where people are. Yes. And then with my personal stories, I can teach the faith in a different way than the priest talking, say, in a homily, or somebody who has been a Catholic his or her whole life.
Yes.
I wasn't. I was like one of those anti, you know, everything church, everything. Spain, you know? Spain
yes,
is a
yes,
very secular
Spanish,
country
yes.
right now, unfortunately. So, by the way, my family is still very secular. I'm okay. the black sheep. So, you know, try to convey my conversion, my transformation to other people. That's what I want to do.
So then how did you feel empowered to do this? You're not a bishop. You're not a priest.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, very humbly. Mm. I don't want to be super Rolling Stones famous. No, I want to very humbly touch hearts. And I'm studying theology. I'm preparing myself because I cannot do this just by talking. And prayer.
Oh.
So basically, those are the three things that helped me.
Would you say that that's what the laity needs, to do those three things in order to also be teaching? Because we want everyone teaching the faith, yeah, and sharing the faith.
Yes. Our faith is so rich. And when you talk to Catholics that don't really know their faith, you realize how much they're missing and how misguided they are about a lot of things. And those are things you cannot just explain, like drinking coffee. Mm. It has to be more than that. So that's why I thought I need to get some those concepts that are so important in our faith and bring them to my life, and with my personal stories, tell people how they can leave those concepts and understand them. But to do that, I need to study myself. Otherwise, I can't. And I need to pray. Mm. Those are the two things. And so very humbly, slowly, but without stopping.
I think that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I hope that you can share this message with many people around the country and around the globe who need to hear it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Living the Faith with Joy was certainly seen at this year's World Youth Day. World Youth Day wrapped up in Lisbon last weekend. The massive gathering drew an estimated 1.5 million people when the Pope arrived. They prayed, danced, spent time at Mass in adoration, a moving time for many who were brought to tears. At the closing Mass, the Holy Father's homily echoed that of Pope John Paul II's "Be not afraid," that he repeated several times to the young people, and assured them that Jesus has a plan for their lives. The next World Youth Day will be held in Seoul, South Korea, in 2027. The stories of our Catholic lives can bring joy even amid sadness. And on that note, one of our faithful EWTN viewers who is at the end stages of a long battle with muscular dystrophy recently accomplished a lifelong desire, and we feature him in our Images of the Week. 33-year-old Michael Hamm has been in a wheelchair most of his life. He grew up watching EWTN and is an ardent fan of our foundress, Mother Angelica, who inspired him to participate in several Catholic charities. When he learned he would not be able to travel much longer, he knew he wanted to visit the birthplace of EWTN. He was able to do so on August 5th, where he got a tour of the studio, he got to see the set Mother Angelica used, and visited the EWTN chapel and met with his favorite friar, Father Patrick.
I've got to say that I said for the first 20 years that I would never have a favorite Franciscan missionary of the Eternal Word, because I love them all. Well, in 2012, the Lord made a liar out of me because he called Father Patrick to the priesthood, and Father Patrick was ordained in 2012. And I remember having the same feeling about him that I did when I was watching Mother Angelica all those years ago. This electricity, this inner light, this idea that holiness was not something that was hard. It was for everybody.
In Mr. Ham's letter to our CEO, Michael Warsaw, he wrote that EWTN has brought more to my life in the last 3 decades than a couple of mere letters can hope to communicate. We're honored that we were able to help make Mr. Ham's wish come true, and we're touched by his love of this network. He will be in our prayers. Please keep him in yours. And that does it for this week's episode of EWTN News in Depth. We'll see you next week.